Good morning. We have some special guests with us today. And they are students from Albany High School. Would they please stand? Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are with us with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if they accept that invitation, they are given materials about the case that they will hear. They come, listen to oral argument, and then meet with a justice after the second oral argument on the day that they appear. Everyone is invited to listen to the discussion at noon. It will be about the procedures of the court, not the substance or substantive issues of the case. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your right hand, the marshal will give you the summary. Indeed, if you raise your left hand, the marshal. All right. Ah, we've got some people here. Ms. Nodoff, Marshal Nodoff. Here we go. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With these introductions made, I will now call our first case for today, the Ho-Chunk Nation versus the Department of Revenue. Arguing for the Ho-Chunk Nation is Michael Murphy. Mr. Murphy.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Murphy. I represent the Ho-Chunk Nation. With me at council table is my colleague Cynthia Butchko. Also with me in the courtroom are members of the Ho-Chunk Nation, their representatives, and officials of the governing body, the legislature of the tribe. We're pleased to be here. As you can tell from the briefs, this case centers on how to interpret Wisconsin Statute 139.323. That is the statute under which the tribe had filed a request for a refund with the Department of Revenue for the collection of certain cigarette taxes, but that is also the statute under which they were denied that refund under only one provision, and that is sub 3 of that provision. And it all comes down to how do you define the word designated, and in fact the phrase designated trust lands. The briefs obviously show that the parties have offered many tools to the court on how to interpret that phrase. Before I jump into that, I think it's useful, though, to just kind of step back and consider what this statute really is in its context and its history. This is a very unique statute in the Wisconsin Code. It was enacted in 1983, at least 139.323. And it came in the historical context of disputes between tribes and states about the collection and imposition of cigarette taxes on tribal lands, on reservations, and trust lands, whether they were enforceable or not. There was a case that took place out in Washington State that actually made it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. We call it Moe. And that kind of served as the context for what happened here with this statute. The Great Lakes Indian Tribal Council got together and had a variety of meetings and sessions with the Department of Revenue. They essentially negotiated the terms of this statute. The Great Lakes Indian Intertribal Council actually had representatives from all of Wisconsin tribes on it. So what it wound up being was a sovereign-to-sovereign negotiation where there were certain rights and benefits exchanged and embodied within the statute. The statute, barring the statute, the state would not have had the right to impose the tax and have it operate on the tribe's lands, and in this case, the Ho-Chunk Nation's territory. This statute calls for tribes to collect the tax on non-members. But in exchange, there's a benefit for the limited infringement on the Ho-Chunk Nation's sovereignty that it agreed to through the enactment of the statute. The benefit is it's essentially a fee-for-service sort of statute. Tribes are allowed to get a refund for 70% of the taxes collected. The statute actually uses the word shall. It's a mandate, as long as the terms of the statute are complied with. So the overall purpose of the statute, I think, is important when you consider how to interpret it. It's a revenue-sharing provision, revenues to the tribe, and actually the state gets some revenues, too, that it thought it was missing before the statute was enacted.
Council, why are you only asking for 2 years' refund?
Well, going back to the genesis of this case, those are the 2 years that have been applied for.
Well, what about the other years? Are you applying for that those two?
Have not been applied for, and I don't think it's even in the record that there are any additional applications. But
that statute's still in effect then, if they were eligible for it?
Yes, I believe it is. You might have picked up on some of the party's briefing leading up to this, some perhaps in footnotes, some debate about whether or not, if this decision goes in the tribe's way, they would be allowed to file for refunds for back years or not. The dispute, I think, is about whether there's a certain statute of limitations that applies. The nation has not submitted additional applications beyond what's in the record here.
Mr. Murphy, does the deed here cover all of the Dujol property or just a portion of it?
It covers all of it, Your Honor. And the deed, we think, is critical for the purpose of meaning to the word designated. Our position is that it has to mean something under the statute. If it doesn't mean anything, it's surplusage. And that goes against standards of statutory construction. The deed, picking up on what you're referring to, Your Honor, from December of 1982, that would meet the requirements of a conveyance under state law. And we pushed this argument because the Tax Appeals Commission brought it up. They had said that the deed did not meet the requirements of a conveyance, but they misapplied that because they thought the United States had to sign it. In fact, looking at the statute, it's the grantor that really just had to sign it, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, then what's the date of designation as you see it?
Well, we have argued two alternatives. The first one is August of 1982, when the Assistant Secretary of Interior in Washington, D.C., sent a letter to the Midwest Area Office of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And that letter directed that the Regional Bureau of Indian Affairs accept the parcel into trust, accept the conveyance. That is our position, that it was a designation. Now, what can get lost in the analysis is whether or not designation should mean the same thing as full, final, official acceptance and acquisition under the federal regulations.
Mr. Murphy, before you go there, what's your other alternative date?
Oh, Your Honor, it was the date for the deed that I referenced.
That's October of 1982?
That's actually December 7, I believe, of 1982. Actually, no, you're right. The deed is October of 82. The December date is a letter that went from the Central Office of the Department of Interior, again, to the Minneapolis office, indicating that they had received the deed.
And so which of those two dates is your alternative date, or both of those?
Well, I'd say the December... The usefulness of the December 82 letter is to indicate that there's no question that this deed had been accepted, had been received by the federal government. But the purpose, of course, on that issue is just looking at whether it satisfies the terms of the state statute for conveyance. Our first argument is that it's actually the August 1982 letter, and that is a good barometer of gauging when something could be designated trust lands under the statute.
Counselor, don't you kind of defeat your own argument on statutory interpretation by telling us designated can mean two different dates? I mean, it seems to me the legislature had something in mind when they wrote the statute, and I don't find it a really strong argument that they could have meant several different dates. I think they either meant one date or they meant another date or they meant some circumstance, but you seem to be arguing, well, it could have been in October or it could have been in August or it could have been in December. I have problems putting all those things into the definition of designate.
Right. Well, Your Honor, our argument is really it's the August 82 letter. I mean, if you look at the fee to trust process, the two parties that are involved in that nationwide are tribes and the federal government. It's those two entities that participate in the taking of land into trust. So a letter such as the one in August 82 from the federal government is the proper designation point in time. We only pushed the deed date as a conveyance because the Tax Appeals Commission analyzed that issue and we thought that they were flawed in their analysis. In terms of the statutory construction, though, you know, we're at a position where the statute itself doesn't define what designated means. The drafting history doesn't appear to indicate what it should mean. We're left with the Legislative Fiscal Bureau reports, the 1985 Attorney General's opinion that talked about it. And stepping back and looking at the purpose, we think it was to allow as many lands, even lands that were undergoing the process of fee to trust, back in 82 and 83, to be considered designated lands.
Well, it sounds to me like you're saying that designate does not require the full, final acceptance by the U.S. government. You interpret designate to mean, if I hear your argument right, it means that enough has happened that shows that this is close to full and final acceptance. And that's why you get several different dates. So some might argue that the August 82 letter from the BIA shows that everything's on track. If you don't like that, we got a signed and executed deed of October 8th, which shows everything's on track. And if you don't like that, you say, maybe that's not sufficient evidence to show it's close enough, then you got the December letter that shows everything's on track. So what you say designate means is the train is running along smoothly, everything is A-OK, close enough, but it hasn't come to a full stop at the station. Is that your argument?
That is essentially the argument. Now, sensing what might be some concerns with that position, the slippery slope, standards, guidelines for lower courts. Our position is that this is going to be a fact-specific inquiry, and it's actually not going to come up very often. Here we are in 2009. The statute was drafted back in 1983. I think the Ho-Chunk Nation was the first one to ever have a live dispute that's certainly gone this far under this statute. The statute has been discussed and interpreted before, such as the 1985 Attorney General opinion, but not specifically on the meaning of the word designate. And I know that opposing counsel's position has been that designate, as well as the Tax Appeals Commission's position, should be full, final federal approval. And they also point to the August of 82 letter from the Department of Interior and say, well, there were conditions on that conveyance that still had to be taken care of before you could be moving the trust. Sure, there were conditions, but the, keep in mind the purpose for which we're looking at this. The conditions on that letter were for the purpose of moving into federal trust, acquisition, acceptance, moving into federal trust. It's different under 139.323.
Mr. Murphy, what do you think about the approach that designated doesn't just modify trust land, but it modifies the word reservation also, and that when you're talking about designated reservation, that there is indeed formal procedures that must be followed in order to become a reservation. And why shouldn't the same approach be taken to trust land? In other words, designated means formal acceptance. Everything is done.
Well, Your Honor, the processes, at least looking at the federal processes, they are different. The process for trust land acquisition set forth in federal regulations, referred to as Part 151. That's not the same process for indicating something as a reservation. In this particular case, the De Joe parcel actually was proclaimed a reservation, but it came after the statutory deadline in 139.323. And that's done through not so much a recognition process, but a notice in the Federal Register. And that's what happened in the Ho-Chunk Nation's case. Those, Your Honor, I think are appropriate means as to the federal issues. But I don't think it really helps define whether or not the state law means the same thing. And while the Tax Appeals Commission or opposing counsel may think that that was a reasonable approach to look to those things, I think that assumes that the Tax Appeals Commission is given a certain level of deference. And in this case, they are not. They even admitted in their own decision that this was an issue of first impression.
Well, but the fact that it's an issue of first impression doesn't necessarily mean they're not entitled to deference. For instance, we have, in many of our cases, the most recent one that comes to mind, I guess, is the Menasha case from last term, where we've talked about the fact that the Tax Appeals Commission is given deference. It's usually due deference or due weight deference. But even in situations where it might be a matter of first impression, because they're charged by the legislature with making this kind of determination. So I don't think we can just foreclose that this is necessarily de novo rather than a due weight or due deference situation. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respectfully take a different position, Your Honor. Looking at the Menasha case, for example, the court there said that its interpretation of the state statute was actually dependent on its interpretation of the Department of Revenue's own regulation. So I think that case has a little bit different layers to it. True, due weight can be given even when it's an issue of first impression, but some of the other cases, such as Daimler Chrysler, Telemark, suggest that what that really means is that the Appeals Commission has actually had some experience applying that particular statute in the past. Even if it's a brand new fact situation, that doesn't equate to a matter of first impression if the Appeals Commission has applied that statute before. This case is not that. This is the Tax Appeals Commission applying 139.323. There's been no application of Chapter 71, Chapter 77. It's just simply 139.323 and its interpretation of the word designated.
Could I ask you a couple of questions, Mr. Murphy? The tribe has a new casino in Wittenberg, if I'm not mistaken. Does the refund statute apply to cigarettes sold on that casino land?
It would if the land had been designated trust land before the January 183 deadline.
But if it wasn't?
Correct.
It wouldn't be.
Under that statute, correct.
All right. But suppose this legislation were being negotiated, immediately before this became trust land in Wittenberg. And the tribe was part of that negotiation. Wouldn't they want to try to get that covered under the Act?
Under that state statute?
Yeah.
Yes, I would think so.
Okay. Now, in this particular case, the state argues that on January 31st, 1983, that's the date when it's what's in effect. But this legislation wasn't passed until July 1983. So this was already trust land at the time this act was passed. Isn't that true? By anyone's definition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So why would the legislature want to discriminate against one piece of trust land but not everything else that's trust land in the state?
I honestly don't know, Your Honor.
Can they?
They set a date.
Right.
January 1st. And they could have said everything that is reservation land or trust land on January 1st, 1983 is going to be covered by this refund agreement. But this had already been designated as trust land by the time they passed this act. So they used a different word. They used designated. And it seems to me, if the was then the Winnebago tribe, now the Ho-Chunk tribe, if they were actively part of negotiating this agreement, they would have covered their own land that was already trust land. This bill wasn't even introduced until after this became trust land. And the amendment, it was an amendment to section 1502 of this, didn't come until well into the process. So I think that's why they used the word designate.
Well, the history, it appears that this tribal group, GLITSI is the acronym, Great Lakes Intertribal Council, as I said, had various members of the different tribes on them. The Ho-Chunk Nation had one of its own members on the committee. I know that same person was also involved in trying to get the Jajo parcel into trust through the federal process.
Who was that?
His name is Harry Steindorf. That actually is that is part of the record, in as much as it was part of the documents we tried to file and supplement the record with in the Court of Appeals. Circuit Court.
If the legislature wanted to do that, it would have been easy to just say everything that's trust land or reservation as of the effective date of this bill. That would have put it beyond the date that it was enacted. It would have put it whatever the publication date is, or they could have had a special date, January 1, 1984. I mean, it would be a lot easier than say designate.
Right. It's a word that we feel is ambiguous because of the context and the history. It could be subject to different meanings. Now,
but counsel, let me just say this to you. If we take your position that designate doesn't mean the full, final federal approval, who else is affected? Any other tribes?
Not that I'm aware of. When this case started, I tried to put out communications to other representatives of the Wisconsin tribes to see if they had a similar situation. I had not received any response, so I don't want to read too much into that. But
what other statutes are affected that would use the word designated as, so that we have issues? Because, one thing about the law is you want clarity, right? And if you say full, final, federal acceptance for this purpose, or for another purpose, full, final acceptance, it's clean, it's clear. Everybody understands it. Everybody's governed by it. There's a bright line rule. The end. I mean, there's something to be said for that in the law, right?
Yes.
So the purpose of my question is, then, if you take your definition, which is fuzzy, with all due respect, right? It's not clean, clear, and precise. I mean, even you can point to several elements or several situations. What damage are we doing to other statutes?
I don't think you are doing damage to other statutes that have this phrase in them. I don't have a concern that there'll be a ripple effect that causes confusion in interpretation of the state statutes, or for the lower courts, for that matter. And that goes to the uniqueness of this particular statute, drafted between two sovereigns. And it's the sovereign influence that I think merits consideration of the Indian canon of construction, too. If the state's canons do not resolve this ambiguity for the court, the Indian law canon of construction, as articulated by the federal courts, and even this court in treaty litigation, not in interpretation of statutes, talks about construing ambiguous statutes that were actually passed for the benefit of tribes in their favor. And we know this statute, it has to have been passed for the benefit of Wisconsin tribes. Their revenues they receive, it's also benefiting the state, but it's clearly benefiting the tribes. Regardless of whether it was an arm's length negotiation, the Indian canon has not been limited by how the law is enacted or the process or whether the tribe actually has some involvement in the adoption of that law. Actually, here, if you look at it, with the tribe being involved in the adoption of this law, it suggests even more so, I think, that it's appropriate to apply the Indian canon. And in this situation, we're asking the court to apply it, construe the word designated trust land in favor of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and grant the application for cigarette refunds that were in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Representing the Wisconsin Department of Revenue, Assistant Attorney General Thomas Freer.
Please, the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Thomas Creeline, and I represent the respondent, Wisconsin Department of Revenue. What the nation has done in this case is to isolate a single word from a statute that contains several provisions and subsections, and then base its entire argument on the sole premise that one word containing all those provisions and subsections didn't necessarily have to be there. You could use the same kind of logic to make an argument that the statute should only be applied to new reservations and not additions to reservations, because otherwise the word A before reservation would be a surplus word. In other words, it could be argued that the legislature would have said designated reservation if it meant to include additions to reservations, and that the legislature put the word A in there so that it would only include new reservations. And I don't, you know.
So I hear you taking your opponent to task for focusing on the word designated. But boy, when I was preparing for this case, I sure focused on it. I see in the first paragraph of the Court of Appeals opinion that that's what the focus of their opinion is, the designated trust land on or before January 3rd. So, I mean, isn't that what this case is about? What does it mean, designated?
The court and the case focus on the phrase designated a reservation or trust land. That's the phrase I'm focusing on. Mm-hmm. My point is that the canon of construction that a statute should be construed so that it, if possible, so that it doesn't have surpluses. Doesn't mean that the legislature, no statutes have surpluses, or that no statute could have had language that was used more precisely than what the language the legislature chose. That's what I'm saying. You can't focus on that exclusion, on that canon, to the exclusion of avoiding unreasonable and absurd results.
I have couple questions regarding the Court of Appeals opinion and the Commission's opinion. The Court of Appeals opinion, in paragraph 11, in discussing the standard of review, says, after talking about deference, however, we agree with the nation that the appropriate standard of review here is de novo rather than due weight deference advocated by the department. De novo review is appropriate when the issue is one of first impression, citing DOR versus River City refuse removal. And the commission itself acknowledged that the issue before it was one of first impression. Now, my recollection is, I know that the commission here acknowledged that the specific issue before it is one of first impression. Is the Court of Appeals correct then, or incorrect in their standard of review?
I think the Court of Appeals is incorrect because this is an issue of state statutory construction involving an excise type statute, and what the court has traditionally said with respect to excise type statutes is that the commission has generalized experience in construing those statutes and therefore is entitled to due weight.
With regard to the commission, it's in our appendix in the blue brief, appendix 46. The commission says, where there is ambiguity in a statute that is intended to benefit Indian tribes, then that statute is to be liberally construed and the ambiguity resolved in the tribe's favor, citing a case of Bryan. However, then they went on to find that the statute was clear and unambiguous. Are they correct? Is the commission correct in their statement?
Well, that's a correct statement of federal Indian law, but the question in this case, and this is the Indian canon of construction issue that's been argued by the nation, the question in this case, and what the court's trying to ascertain, is the intent of the legislature. And the Indian canon of construction doesn't assist the court in any way in ascertaining the intent of the legislature.
I just want to find out what's correct and incorrect, let's say, in the commission. Now, you don't agree with the commission that the language, the word designate, is a plain meaning, do you?
If the application of the plain meaning rule means that you rule out those definitions that yield unreasonable and absurd results, then I think that designated a reservation or trust land does have a plain meaning.
Let me try it from a easier route. Is the word designate in the statute clear and unambiguous?
The phrase designated a reservation or trust land is unambiguous if you rule out those dictionary definitions that have unreasonable and absurd results.
Well, so it's clear conditionally. I mean, look, I say to the students here, I say, Albany students, you're great. In fact, you're some of the best students we've had here. And I want you to designate someone to come up and get an award from the chief afterwards. And it's going to say award for really being good. Now, I asked them to designate. Does that mean when they select or point someone out or decide? Or does that mean they come up and get the award when it's a fait accompli? What is it?
I think the way you used it, they would select somebody to come up.
Mm-hmm. So they don't have to come and get the award. It doesn't have to be acquiring the award or receiving the award, does it?
Not in the context in which
you use it. So why here? Now, I looked at the Court of Appeals opinion, and they took the word designate, and they transposed it and used the word acquire. Seems to me, and then they analyzed whether or not it was acquired. Seems to me if the legislature wants to say acquire, they can say acquire. If they want to say designate, they can say designate, but with all due respect, I think designate is kind of a, has the potential to be a squishy word.
What,
temporarily, you know.
First of all, what the Court of Appeals first discussed was various dictionary definitions of designated.
Mm-hmm.
And the Court of Appeals specifically indicated that there are dictionary definitions of designated, such as specify, give a name and title to, and characterize, that do indicate finality, even if you use a dictionary definition instead of a technical meaning. What the Court of Appeals also said is that you look at the context of the statute. The statute is dealing with federal processes, federal processes for land becoming reservation land, federal processes for land becoming trust lands. So we're going to use a technical meaning and look at how those technical procedures apply.
Could I ask you a question? You're familiar with Hillary Clinton.
I am.
Okay. Is it true that at one point that she was Secretary of State designate?
Yes.
And then she was confirmed?
Yes.
And isn't it true that Tom Daschle at one point was Secretary of Health and Family Services designate?
Yes.
But not anymore.
He was never confirmed.
All right. And that is exactly the word that is used on, by the president-elect's office, designate. So there's a certain, someone is designated, but it doesn't always come through. But nobody's going to be able to collect tax revenues on refunds unless it actually goes through. And at the time that the legislature passed this act, maybe they didn't know exactly what was being designated, what was in the process or not. Well, I think the basic question I would have to ask you is why 5 months after, or maybe four, about 5 months after this was trust land, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, why would the legislature have discriminated against the Dajoe trust land as opposed to all the other reservation and trust land in the state? Why would they have done that?
I don't know that the legislature was, there's no indication the legislature, at least in the legislative history, was even aware of the timing of the Dajoe land being taken into trust.
Yeah, I mean, but the documents provided by your opposing counsel thought this was a negotiation. This was a political settlement about taxes, cigarette taxes imposed on people who purchased them on Indian reservations and trust land. That was a political settlement. It was all worked out in the Joint Committee on Finance. You know that because it is not in the governor's original revenue bill, budget bill. It's an amendment to that bill.
I agree that that's the way it was worked out.
Counselor, I have a question that probably is, you'll find very academic, but I need to know the answer to it. There's a 1968 Attorney General's opinion that says Section 139.31, which is the statutory section that requires an excise tax on cigarettes, does not apply on tribal reservations. Do you agree with that? So they could, my question is, could on the Dajoe property, could they just say, well, hey, you guys are not going to give us a refund, so we're not going to collect the taxes anymore?
Well,
or charge them, obviously.
Well, tying your question with Justice Prosser's question, that is the negotiation that took place, is that that's exactly what was going on during this time period, is that tribes were refusing to collect state cigarette excise taxes, and even though in theory those state taxes were enforceable by the states, in practice, there was no efficacious way for the state to collect that money on reservation or trust land because tribes have sovereign immunity. So that is why the negotiation took place, and that is why the tribes paid money essentially to enforce state law that the federal courts had said they were supposed to enforce.
Okay, but my question still is, okay, just say we agree with your argument, and the DeJobe property wasn't trust property before the requisite January 1st of 1983. Can the Ho-Chunk Nation say, well, cool, we're just not going to collect taxes anymore, and our cigarettes will cost a lot less than the folks around us in Madison are selling them for? That's what we choose to do. You don't recognize that this was trust land at the appropriate time to fit within the statute, so hey, we're just not doing it anymore. Can they do that?
In theory, they can, and there are still difficult enforcement problems. If they did that, my best guess is that the legislature would revisit this statute.
Okay, so what you're saying to me is that the Attorney General's opinion that was given in 1968 about 139.31 may, at this point, still be applicable. Does the federal government have anything to say about what the state can force them to do on reservation land or not force them to do?
Well, I mean, the federal courts have said, and there are ways you can collect these taxes. You have the cigarettes stamped by the distributor before they're delivered to the reservation. But the federal government, to my knowledge, has never exercised any authority with respect to tribes to require them to collect state taxes.
Okay, so at this point in time, there hasn't been any kind of an enforcement action. So, if you get your wish today, maybe you'll get something different than you thought you were going to get.
I can't speak to what action the Ho-Chunk Nation may take if it loses this case. I mean, certainly, as far as I know, everything between the department and the Ho-Chunk during this case has been very amicable.
Oh, I don't think that it would be anything else. I'm not trying to suggest that. I was just curious that if this, in fact, was a settlement based on a former opinion of the Attorney General that the state could not enforce the excise tax on cigarettes sold on the reservation. And this negotiation says, well, if they're sold, yeah, we'll collect the taxes, but we'll only give the state part of them and the nation will take part of them. But if the nation's not going to get part of them, then what's the nation's reason for not going back to the old rule, which said, we just don't collect these?
I don't know.
Okay.
Going back to that opinion, which I have to be real honest, and I don't recall the opinion specifically right now, but I think it may have had to do with sales taxes, and it was thought at that time, I believe, that a sales tax could not be collected, but that an excise tax could be. So I'm not sure what that opinion is referring to.
Counsel, I have nothing more, I confess, other than the statutes before me, and at the very end of 139.31, when it gives a little bit of a history, it also refers to that 68 Attorney General Opinion 151, and it says, state cigarette tax laws do not apply to Indian persons or Indian tribes selling cigarettes on Indian reservations.
That is true. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about 70% of all the revenue from the excise tax for cigarettes that are sold to anyone on the reservation.
You mean non-Indians?
Not everyone.
Yeah. And this only covered Indians?
Yes.
With respect to the word designated, Mr. Murphy was asked this question. I think it's important because when we reach a conclusion and a decision, other people in other areas of statutes are going to use that as guidance. Have you taken a look at other words and phrases or other areas of the statutes where the word designated is used? Because I've just done a real quick look at that up here. And it looks like the word designated is used in a variety of different situations within the statutes to define agencies or family members or local agencies. Then you go further and you look at in the transportation statutes, 85, designated service areas. They're not service areas until they actually are designated service areas. Conservation statutes, designated natural resource areas. They're not natural until they're actually designated. It's a done deal. Mooring areas. A mooring area could be anywhere in a navigable water, but it's really not a mooring area until it's designated as such. And car safety seats, the word designated is used there, and then it specifically cites to the federal regulations with respect to that. Have you taken a look at that issue to see how, if at all, this decision could impact how that phrase is used in, at least from what I can tell, you know, half a dozen or so other areas of the statutes?
Well, I haven't looked at all the areas that you've obviously looked at. We do mention two tax statutes in our brief, 7303-2A and 7536-2A. And the first of those uses the phrase property that is designated as a historic landmark. And clearly that statute means that the process is complete and that the property actually is a historic landmark. The same thing in another tax statute, 7536-2A, lands designated as forest croplands or managed forest lands, in order to qualify under that statute, the lands actually have to be forest croplands or managed forest lands.
Are there cases that so say, or is that your position?
It's my position that that can be ascertained from simply looking at those two statutes.
Well, because you're using a particular definition of designate. And that's the definition you want in all three statutes.
Yes.
Now, the usual rule is that statute is not ambiguous if you can get its meaning from the dictionary or the context, right? Adjacent words, neighboring words, neighboring sections, etc. The problem we have here, which was raised by Justices Bradley and Prosser, is that you've got a word that has several definitions. Some of those definitions you think, or at least one, apply here and you want us to use it. But there are others that that you don't necessarily want us to use. So how does the court choose the definition when it has several choices? What's the principle for choosing your definition or choosing someone else's definition? It sounds to me as if you have choices about definitions, it's ambiguous.
I think you rule out those dictionary definitions or other definitions that yield unreasonable and absurd results. And I think if you look at the way that land, fee land becomes reservation land, and the way that fee land becomes trust land, it is unreasonable and absurd to say that unspecified preliminary or intermediate steps in the process constitute designation.
Yeah, but in answer to Justice Bradley's question about who is going to be designated to get the award, which is going to be very valuable, that I'm going to give, you agreed that it's at the point of selection, not when the person finally appears here.
I agreed that in the context in which
you
used
so the you've got a word that can be used in a variety of ways. You agreed with the Justice Prosser that a secretary designate means somebody selected, but the final hasn't been done yet. Agreed on that. So it seems to me, are you willing to agree that designate is ambiguous?
I agree that designated has several dictionary definitions. I do not agree that designated a reservation or trust land in this context has more than one definition that doesn't yield an unreasonable and absurd result.
Counsel, let's look at the Court of Appeals definition, paragraph 23 of their opinion. And elsewhere, it's in paragraph, it's in the blue brief at, it's appendix, yes, thank you. It would be appendix 13, but the paragraph 23. It states, thus, if the department is correct that designated trust land means the act by which the United States government acquires the land in trust, then the department is correct that this did not occur until January 31, 1983. I interpret not only here but other places, for instance, the use of the word acquire in paragraph 22, the use of the word acquire in paragraph 21 of the Court of Appeals and other places, that they are interpreting designate here to mean acquire. Am I correct or incorrect?
They're interpreting designate to be the final process by which land becomes trust land under the regulation. Now, but there is a federal regulation. 25 CFR 151.3.
Let's just try to stay, maybe I shouldn't stay with my question, because sometimes in response I get better ideas and information, but I circled acquire several times in the opinion, and it appears to me, and it's focused in paragraph 23, that the department is saying designate here means acquires land in trust. You agree with that or you disagree with that?
I essentially agree with that.
My concern is the statute that you pointed in response to Justice Ziegler's question, 7631-2A, there the legislature used both the words acquire and designated. Now generally, if it's both, if it's in the same subsection, 2A, generally they don't use different words to mean the same thing. It says in 2A, if property is acquired, and then it goes on a little later in 2A, just a few sentences, actually it's in the very next sentence, in the case of lands designated, and that's what you were pointing to, so how do I... obviously, they know how to say acquire. They know how to say designated. They did that in the statute you pointed to, the statute you designated, 7536 2A, in response to Justice Ziegler's question. So why didn't they say acquire in the statute that we're dealing with if they mean acquire? They can...
First, they're dealing with a multitude of things. They're dealing with how land becomes a reservation or is added to a reservation, how land becomes trust land. And one of the ways that either of those things can be done, and I've been hoping to get to this, is through an act of Congress. And that, if on fee land, that is the way that land becomes reservation land. They couldn't possibly have been referring to intermediate steps in the process. I mean, is the land designated when the bill is introduced in Congress? Is the land designated when it passes one house, when it passes both houses, when it's sitting on the president's desk?
I don't know.
I say no. I say it's not designated until the president signs the bill.
Mr. Greer, what utility would this statutory scheme and concern in regard to the collection of cigarette taxes have to do if the fee-to-trust process had not been completed? What utility would it have? Would it have any application at all?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Well, can you imagine any scenario where it would have any application. I mean, if it's not, if the fee to trust process had not been completed, how could any of this statutory scheme in regard to the refund of taxes occur?
Well, I mean, another issue with respect to that is how long was the legislature willing to wait? You know, these trust applications, I mean, look at the Dairyland Casino, the Beloit Casino. These trust applications can be very politically charged and can take a long time to process. And I don't think the legislature, it's a reasonable reading of that statute, that the legislature intended that there be some kind of unspecified waiting period for land to become trust.
Well, and not just a waiting period, but there are several intermediary steps. It's been suggested by your opposing counsel that the date of designation was August 20, 1982, the date that the assistant secretary authorized the Minneapolis BIA to acquire the property. Is that consistent with your understanding of the argument?
That's my understanding of the argument, but as the Tax Appeals Commission pointed out, the nation didn't even own the land.
Well, and that brings me to my next question. Unlike a scenario or a hypothetical where we ask the students to designate one of their own merely to come up to the bench to receive an award, what steps needed to take place in between that August 20, 1982 date and the date that the fee to trust process was actually completed?
Every single step in the regulation up to and through and including formal acceptance.
Well, and including...
That's what 25 CFR 151.3 says.
And including a marketability study to determine whether the land actually was marketable.
Whether it had title defects.
Whether it had title. And are you aware of any cases where such applications have been rejected because the land had found not to have marketable title?
I'm not personally aware of any. I'm not aware of any cases where that has or has not happened. I'm not involved in those kinds of processes.
Counselor, I want to shift you over to something you haven't talked about yet, because I can see your yellow light is on there. And my question is twofold. First of all, was 139.323 sub 3 enacted for the benefit of the Indian tribes?
Not in the sense of the Indian canon of construction where, you know, the federal government has a special trust relationship with the tribes. The statute was enacted to provide a financial incentives for the tribe to enforce state law on reservation and trust land.
But they were collecting and keeping, under the law, 70% of all the taxes, right?
They only get the 70% if they fall within this.
If they get a refund, okay, and that was money that they weren't collecting before because they weren't collecting taxes, if I understood our past conversation, correct?
Well, they were getting a lot of cigarette revenues, you know, through cigarette sales on the reservation.
True, but they would still get cigarette revenues later. They just now add a tax to it, correct?
I think so. I'm not certain.
Well, they wouldn't add a tax. They wouldn't have anything to pay to the government. The government wouldn't have anything to give them a refund on, right?
Correct.
Okay. So they're certainly getting some benefit, and if I understand your argument, you don't think the Indian canon of construction should be applied here because it's a federal canon, not necessarily applicable to state law, and you don't think the statute's ambiguous and it only applies with ambiguous statutes. Is that correct, or is there something else?
Well, I don't think the policy reasons behind the Indian canon of construction, which is the special federal trust relationship with the tribes, mm-hmm. Have anything to do with the enactment of this statute. The policy reasons behind federal Indian law have nothing to do with ascertaining legislative intent in enacting this statute.
Let me see if I can clarify something. Prior to the enactment of the statute with which we are now dealing, should the Indian tribes have collected the tax when the cigarettes were sold to non-Indians?
They should have.
So, and then would have paid 100% of that tax to the Department of Revenue, to the state of Wisconsin.
They should have.
and they would have gotten nothing back.
That's correct.
And under this statute, a compromise is reached, right?
Yes.
Do they collect taxes from everybody, cigarette taxes from everybody? And they pay back, and they, if they file a refund, and if they file it timely, and if they fall within the statute, they get 70% back?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Chief, I think that might clarify something.
Chief, if I may.
If the statute is ambiguous, and I know you're suggesting that maybe it is, or maybe it isn't, but it's not clear. If the statute is ambiguous, and if the purpose, as you just said, the statute was enacted to provide a financial incentive for the tribe to collect cigarette taxes, why shouldn't it be construed in light of the purpose, if it's ambiguous?
I think it's construed using the canons of constructions that apply to state tax statutes.
Doesn't the canon of construction that an ambiguous statute should be informed by the purpose of the legislation, doesn't that tool of construction apply to tax statutes also?
Well, tax statutes have their own special.
I know that, and they have some that don't apply to others. My question is, does that tool of construction, that a statute, if ambiguous, should be interpreted consistent with its purpose, does that tool of construction apply to tax statutes?
That is a tool that the court uses, but it's not the only tool.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Creon. Mr. Murphy, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, after hearing the arguments, I think the meaning of the word designated may still be, as Your Honor said, fuzzy or squishy. Our position is that it is an ambiguously used word, but that in interpreting the phrase, we ask the court to consider the context in which it was enacted, the purposes for which it was enacted. Also look at the way it has been amended over the years. The Wisconsin legislature in 1999 amended the statute, not 139.323, but the definitional provisions before that. They created subsection 13M and defined the word trust lands. Yet, they didn't go back to 0.323 and do anything with the word designated. They left it. So, if you're trying to piece together construction, looking at 13M's definition of trust lands, the introductory language within 139.323, which just uses the word trust land, you still have to look at subsection 3, which says designated trust lands. And if the legislature intended to change that and actually make it mean the federal process for fully acquiring lands into trust, I think they would have done that.
It would seem to me the legislature would have understood that Indian tribes were in the position of acquiring more trust land after the statute passed. And they put in a date to cut off all of the future trust land. But here, this piece of land was already trust land when the bill passed. It would seem to me the legislature could no more discriminate against this piece of land than they could have discriminated against an individual tribe.
Correct, and Your Honor, I can't, I don't know exactly what the cause that it was, what explains the differences in dates. I know that there's, as you know full well, as the court does, there's a legislative process that's political and has built in delays.
But you don't argue they're discriminating here in an unconstitutional way?
No, we have not argued that, Your Honor. No.
Legislature can cut off dates. 18 can cut off ages, 18, 19. Person becomes 18 on January 2, they cut it off January 1.
They do it quite often.
Even if the legislation was enacted in July afterwards. Right?
Correct. Yep. My final point goes back to the Indian canon. And I want to just indicate that the basis for applying the canon, the rationale behind the canon, it does apply here. It can be applied here. Specifically, because of the purposes and the history behind the enactment of this statute. If this, say, were a statute that was just singularly adopted by the legislature with no involvement of the tribes of Wisconsin, not a negotiated sovereign-to-sovereign agreement, then perhaps I could lean a little more this way and buy into the argument that the rationale does not equally apply. But that's not what this statute embodies. It does involve sovereign interests. It involves the sovereignty of all the tribes of Wisconsin, including the Ho-Chunk Nation, agreeing to a limited infringement of their sovereign rights to allow the state law to apply where it might not otherwise apply.
Counselor, are you telling us that on all tribal properties subsequent to this agreement, taxes on cigarettes were collected, whether they were sold to members or not, non-members of the tribes, that they were all collected? And in some places, for example, the Ho-Chunk Casino in the Dells, which has been in existence for a long time, they get back 70% of what they collect. But casinos that came about later, and just say, for example, the Potawatomi came about later, they collect them, but they don't get anything back. Is that what you're telling me, that was the agreement?
Well, I'm not sure, you know, exactly what happens with Potawatomi or any other tribes besides Ho-Chunk. As to Ho-Chunk, I know that for lands that were designated trust prior to the cutoff date, they do submit applications for refunds and they get them at their various locations throughout the state of Wisconsin.
Sure.
I'm just not sure what happens with the other tribes, but you know, looking at the impact beyond Ho-Chunk Nation and applicability to other tribes, I think that date would still be applicable.
Okay, so it would, all tribes are part of the agreement. You're not telling us this was an agreement specific to the Ho-Chunk Nation.
No, Your Honor. But as each of Wisconsin's tribes participated in this Great Lakes Intertribal Council with their own representatives, they're in a sense at the table reaching a compromise agreement. So each tribe has a sovereign interest embodied within the statute.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy, and thank you, Mr. Crearon, for your very interesting arguments today on a statute the court has not looked at before relating to the tribes. That concludes our hearing on 07AP 1985, Ho-Chunk Nation versus the Department of Revenue. The court will be in recess for a few moments so that the people who wish to leave may do so, and we have another group of students who wish to come into the courtroom. We are in recess for a few moments.